Good morning. KPCW News. Time is now 8:06. You are listening to the local news hour. Well, let's find out what we've got in store for our weather this weekend. Here with a report is Seth Saunders from the ABC4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday. I'm ABC4 weather forecaster Seth Saunders. Temperatures are in the 60s out there right now across the Wasatch Back. We'll be warming up quickly, though, hitting the 70s by about 10 o'clock. By noon, already in the mid-80s for the Wasatch Back, particularly Park City, where they'll be climbing into the upper 80s and low 90s. A daytime high of 92 degrees is forecasted for the Park City area with just a light breeze. Expect increase in cloud coverage throughout the day and isolated showers and thunderstorms to pick up in the afternoon with the heat of the day, hopefully providing a slight cool down from the heat. Those showers and thunderstorms are expected to hold through tonight, an overnight low of around 60 degrees, fairly mild. And then as we get into your Saturday, we are going to be kicking off the day with mostly sunny skies, but that moisture is still going to be present. So with the heat of the day, we could be looking at more showers and thunderstorms for your Saturday. A daytime high of 86, eventually dropping to 59 late Saturday night into Sunday morning. Showers still expected to be holding on with this monsoon push. By Sunday, we do still have some moisture out there. We'll start the day off with mostly sunny skies, similar to Saturday. We'll top out with a high in the mid-80s for Park City. And then with the heat of the day, we add that potential for showers and thunderstorms, especially as we get into Saturday night. Monday, that wet weather potential really starts to back off, but there will still be some lingering moisture Monday, Tuesday, and into Wednesday. So there is going to be a slight chance of thunderstorms for the first half of next week. Doesn't look too significant, though, right now. Shouldn't cancel your outdoor plans just because of it. Just keep your eyes to the skies. Temperatures will be gradually cooling as we get into next week. A daytime high of 83 degrees on Monday. Tuesday, 82 degrees. And then Wednesday, we start to warm back up ever so slightly with a high of 84 for both your Wednesday and Thursday. Today should be the hottest day over the next week. Isolated showers and thunderstorms expected today all the way through Sunday. But there is that slight chance into next week. So just stay weather aware when you're out there. With monsoon pushes like these, we can see thunderstorms pop up very quickly. The slightest change in the wind can make the biggest differences. So just keep an umbrella in the car, just in case. From ABC4, I'm weather forecaster Seth Saunders. Have a great day.
Let me tell you a little about what we got coming up. Immediately, I'm about to speak with, and certainly not sing with, Liesl Wangerman and cast member Joshua Hughes from the Park City Opera. After that, Mayor Ryan Dickey's going to stop by with a recap of last night's council meeting, and then we'll dig into a conversation with Helen Nadel of Summit Community Garden and Eats, and we'll even finish our hour by a quick chat with Amber Johnson and Sarah Irvin about tonight's Back Alley Bash.
Heber City has used license plate reader technology for over 15 years. Police Chief Parker Sever says the department made the switch to cameras from Fox Safety in 2024 because it's more affordable than other companies. There are 8 cameras around the city. NPR reports the license plate reader technology has drawn scrutiny over who can access the data from local cameras, especially when it comes to federal immigration enforcement. At a meeting with the Heber City Council August 18th, Sever explained the cameras don't monitor individuals and the data is used for specific cases.
We've solved many hit and run accidents with utilizing this system. We've located missing persons from out of state. We've had hits on 2 homicide suspects wanted on the Wasatch Front that were in our community.
Sever says since the cameras capture vehicles' rear license plates, they aren't intended to show officers who's in the vehicle.
It does not provide us registration information, does not provide us insurance information, does not provide us immigration status, does not provide us any identifying information other than a picture of a license plate.
NPR reports many local agencies have shared their data more broadly than they realized, and federal agencies, including U.S. Border Patrol, have searched that data. Some U.S. cities have stopped using flock cameras to prevent immigration enforcement agencies from accessing their data, according to the New York Times. Concern over the technology has also sparked a deflock movement of people mapping the camera's locations. Sever says Heber City's data is secure and federal agents cannot freely use it.
The data is never sold to a third party. It is the property of Heber City, and nobody else has access to that unless I grant them access.
Councilmember Aaron Cheatwood said he felt reassured about data privacy after talking with a flock representative. Councilmember Yvonne Barney said she understands some residents' feeling that they, quote, don't want Big Brother to be watching them.
It's not like we're in a crime-ridden area and people start to ask questions. Well, gee, are you doing it for ICE? Who's doing this? Who's enforcing this and who's trying to? So I'm wondering if we can, for the future, maybe have Flock, your representative, come back. Let's have a little bit bigger discussion.
She proposed posting more information about the technology on the city's website. A spokesperson for the Wasatch County Sheriff's Office says the agency doesn't have any license plate readers. In Summit County, two license plate cameras from Motorola Solutions were recently vandalized. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Park City Opera will be staging its production of Romeo and Juliet tonight and Sunday afternoon at the Eccles Theater here in Park City. Here to give us a preview, we have director Liesl Wangerman, I'll pronounce that right eventually, and cast member Joshua Hughes from the Park City Opera. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
There we go.
Thank you for having us.
Well, we appreciate your being here. Liesl, let's start with a little bit about the background of the Park City Opera. How long has it been in existence and how does it operate?
Yeah, so we founded in March 2024 and we did our first fully staged production last summer 2025 with The Barber of Seville. I hope many of your listeners were able to attend that production. And after the warm reception we received to what we were doing, we were able to produce not one but two full shows this summer. We started with The Tenderland back in July and we are so excited about Romeo and Juliet tonight and on Sunday because it is the biggest show we have ever produced. Mm-hmm. We have over 24 singers on stage, over 40 orchestra members in the pit, and 8 dancers from Ballet West's second company joining us. So it is a true collaboration, a true embodiment of what French grand opera can and should be, and we are so excited to be sharing it with audiences this weekend.
Is that traditionally how the opera was staged, with ballet dancers?
So Romeo and Juliet has a very long and complicated history. It was produced by multiple opera houses in Paris, some of which included dance and some of which didn't. And so sometimes nowadays there are no dancers involved in Romeo and Juliet at all in a lot of productions. It's a really amazing opportunity for us to be able to produce it with true ballet dancers, amazing ballerinas. They're on point. They're stunning. It's incredible and a really special experience.
How long does it take to put something like that together?
A long time.
Josh, when did you start rehearsing?
Well, I started my personal rehearsal. So as opera singers, we have to put in the work before we even show up to actually to the site to rehearsal to learn it ourselves. So I started several months ago learning the French, learning the music, working with my own personal voice teachers and coaches. And then we showed up here 3 weeks ago, the entire cast, and then we put the final pieces together.
And do you guys rehearse separately? The singers and the dancers and the orchestra rehearse separately? Do you like start rehearsing with the soundtrack?
We start rehearsing with a pianist, actually.
Okay.
So a repetiteur actually plays the orchestral score, a reduction on the piano, and that's how we learn our staging. And then by the last week, I would say, we put everything together, the dancers, the full orchestra, getting into the theater.
You know, when I was in elementary school, there were kids who wanted to be astronauts and kids who wanted to be firemen and policemen. Not one of them identified as having an ambition to become an opera singer. Tell me a little bit about your career track. How did you get here?
Well, for me, it was always, I enjoyed singing, but I didn't realize opera was available to me. And so I was singing mainly like in musical theater, which is what is usually available to kids in middle school and high school. And then I started taking voice lessons, and my teacher kind of taught me a classical technique, and that introduced me to the world of classical music and to opera, and I haven't looked back since.
Do you have to, how many different languages have you had to perform in?
Well, Italian, French, German, English, Spanish, so at least 5 big ones, and then probably Czech, 3, so maybe 8.
But let me just tell audiences who are worried about the French language barrier, there will be English super titles projected over the stage, so you will know exactly what is happening at all times in the opera.
I was about to ask you, so how does that work? They're basically closed captions, right?
Yes.
Except they're open captions.
Yeah, so part of my process as the director and Benjamin Beckman's process as the conductor is that we meet and talk through every moment in the music and every moment in the text, and we develop our own translation. I took French for many years and I use some source materials, but we make sure that the translation is in line with the way that we interpret the piece and interpret what's happening. And then we make sure that it is in a verbiage that is accessible and relatable to how we see a story and talk nowadays.
Yeah, I want to stay on that for a minute, because I would have thought that, like, when you get the big package of opera materials from the publisher that goes with the license, there would have been a canned translation. But it sounds
There is. So okay. Some scores do have an English translation written in them that mm-hmm. goes along with the music, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not always the best translation, right? Because French syllables and the way that their sentences are structured is very different than the way it is structured in English. And so we have the translation that's in the score, but you also have things called librettos and libretto translations. So that's when people just take the text separate from the music and translate it word for word.
So and I take it, does it also sort of tell me a little bit about background of what's going on? It's not just what they're saying?
So there is like a setting of the scene.
Right.
So you know exactly where you are at all times.
And tell me a little bit about the history of this opera. When was it first performed, and who's the composer?
The composer is Charles Gounod, and it was written in the 1800s, around the time of the Paris Exposition. So the World Fair. Yes.
Yeah, 1860, I believe.
Okay, yes. Okay. Late 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And it was performed the year that it was premiered. It got then performed over 90 times in Paris. So it was a great success that first year, and has since had a really, really long and wonderful history of many, many performances and many, many different interpretations. Yeah.
Yeah, it really put the composer Gounod on the map, on the international map, because people were visiting from all over the world, saw the opera, told their friends about it at home, and it was performed in multiple countries within just a few years.
So it sounds like the 19th century version of going viral.
Yeah.
Yes,
it absolutely
exactly.
Went viral.
And that was partially because of the World Fair, because people came to Paris for the World Fair, saw the opera, and then took it to their cities and wanted to stage productions of it.
So, Josh, what has been challenging about the role? You play the father of a rather challenging young woman as Per Capulet. Tell us a little bit about the challenges of that role.
Well, the challenge is that with this opera, Gounod really chooses to focus on the love story. So some smaller characters are cut, and then characters like Juliet's father have a lot of lines that are cut because, you know, he's there, but we're really focusing on Romeo and Juliet, of course. So for me, reading through the Shakespeare again and seeing, oh, he has a wonderful monologue here, but then when I look at the opera, oh, that's condensed down to about 20 seconds of singing. So there's a lot of background that I'm trying to put into a bit of singing. But it makes it really interesting, and it makes it a really rich performance.
And tell us a little bit about, I presume we do not have a full cast of qualified opera singers who reside full-time here in Park City. Tell us a little bit about how you put a cast together like this.
Well, that's a great question, and I want to push back on that idea, because there's so many amazing and wonderful artists located here in Park City and mm-hmm. in the Valley, and our orchestra is entirely made of local musicians, so that's wonderful, and our chorus is also made entirely of local musicians. Many of them are students at the U and at BYU or recent graduates, and they are just incredible. And our Juliet is actually lives in Salt Lake City now as well. So a lot of our cast lives here or in the area, and we are so lucky to have them. And then the people that we brought in all participated in a national audition process that we started conducting back in the fall. And so many people applied from all over the country, and you know, there's so many talented, amazing singers out there. And what we do with Park City Opera is unique. We ask singers to do some things differently than they might expect in a traditional opera setting. And we do so many concert series. So we're looking for singers who do art song, sing musical theater, and perform their roles amazingly. So it's a really wonderful process, and we get to meet so many people through it. And we feel really lucky with the cast that we were able to collect here.
Well, that's a fascinating concept. I'm envisioning some kind of version of Opera American Idol. That sounds like that's not completely off. How do you stage that set of audition? Is it done live?
Yes, so we have a virtual round where people submit videos, and then we review every video, and we also have people submit a little like introduction to themselves, so we get to know a little bit more about what they're like and what their passions are and what they love about what they're doing. And then out of that, after that round, we invite people for live auditions, either through Zoom or to come here and sing for us in person.
Well, I'm thinking about the number of people involved and the quality of the people that it sounds like you brought in. And of course, my mind goes to money. How do you finance something like this? And how does your organization sort of work from a financial perspective?
That's a great question. So we have so many wonderful individual supporters who over the past year have contributed so generously to make this possible. But we also receive really wonderful support from the RAP tax grant and the cultural grant and the restaurant tax grant as well that play a huge role in supporting what we do and specifically this production.
Okay, so some of the artists are local. Some of the artists are from other parts of the country. Tell us a little bit about the stars. Where are they from? Who are they?
Yeah, so Nicole...
Other than Joshua.
Yeah. I'm right here.
Yeah. Nicole Heinen originally was based in Louisiana, but now is based here in Salt Lake City, and we're so lucky to have her as our Juliet.
And her husband is actually our principal trumpet player in the pit. He also plays in the Utah Symphony.
Yes, so fun fact there, and a really fun affair for them. And then our Romeo, his name is Patrick Bessenbacher, and he is based in St. Louis. And yes.
A star on the rise,
yeah,
for sure. I did a show with him 3 years ago, and to see him now, I'm very excited to see where he's going to go. And so you have to get there to the theater and see them.
And we're gonna do this twice. I'm going to ask you first time, when are the performances?
We have a performance tonight, Friday the 21st at 7 p.m., and Sunday the 23rd at 3 p.m.
Josh, I asked you a little bit about your career arc, but you just mentioned you performed with somebody 3 years ago. What do you do all year? I mean, do you go from performance to performance? How does this, the life of a vagabond opera singer. Tell me about how it works.
That's exactly what it is, that we're hired on just short-term basis, on a short-term basis for every gig. Mm-hmm. And so while I'm on this gig, I'm thinking about what's next. And so I'll go home. I live in Las Vegas. And luckily, my next opera will be in Las Vegas. But then my one after that will be in Tampa, Florida. And so you go home and you do your work and learn your music. And then you go to the next show.
And how far out does it get scheduled? I mean, when is Tampa, for example?
Tampa is in March. Okay. And so that was scheduled a few months ago. So usually about 6 months to a year out at this level we're scheduled.
Okay. What other events does Park City Opera plan for this year?
So we're coming to the end of our summer season. I don't know if anyone has seen us at the City Park Bandstand, but we've been there every single Monday for the past 6 Mondays doing opera around the world with Mountain Town Music. And so after Romeo and Juliet closes on Sunday, we have one more grand finale performance with music from across the globe. That's 6:30 p.m. at City Park, and that's free to attend.
I'm sorry, when is that one?
6:30 p.m. on Monday night at the City Park Bandstand.
And then, have you already started planning next year?
Yes, but we're not quite
any
ready
reveals?
To.
No, I've got nothing for me.
Well, I want to know.
Yeah, if you come tonight, there might be a reveal.
Oh,
so.
What a tease. Mm-hmm, okay, mm-hmm. So that's a good. All right, so again, tonight at 6 to
7 p.m. tonight.
Yeah. And what time on Monday? On
3 p.m. on Sunday.
Okay. For our listeners who are now getting excited and want to learn more and buy some tickets, tell me, where do they go?
ParkCityOpera.org. You can find all the information there about tickets, about our amazing cast, which, you know, I can't talk more highly about them. And also, you can find a Spotify playlist that takes you through the plot of the opera. So if you want to learn more and familiarize yourself with the music, you can go to our website.
So there's a Spotify. Is there also a libretto available? So if you really wanted to understand what was about to go on?
So in the Spotify playlist, we actually have like little mini podcast episodes that are 15 seconds, 30 seconds long that just tells you what that next piece is going to be about. So it gives you that context without you having to read through the whole thing.
Okay.
And there will be a pre-show talk, correct?
Yes. Oh my goodness. I am talking with our amazing choreographer, Michael Waldrop, about kind of the creative process and how we came up with what this production would look like visually and how dance was going to be incorporated.
Okay. We've been speaking with Liesl Wangerman and cast member Joshua Hughes from the Park City Opera about their upcoming production of Romeo and Juliet. Anything else you guys want to add before we go?
We'll see you there.
We'll see you there.
Thanks for spending time with us. Snyderville Basin voters will decide whether they want to issue $71 million for new recreation facilities in November. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the details are unclear since the amount of bonds has been cut.
The Summit County Council greenlit Basin Rec's downsized bond proposal on Wednesday, officially sending it to the November 3rd ballot. Councilmember Megan McKenna and her colleagues thanked recreation district leaders for downsizing the proposal from $150 million to $71 million.
thanks for hearing the feedback from the community and from the council. I think that shows a lot that you were able to come back, and especially so quickly with a modified plan.
The details of what $71 million can get the district still need to be worked out. Basin Rec Director Robert Parrish says he and his staff are meeting with architects in September.
There are outdoor amenities and play structures and park structures that we can put on the properties that we have that aren't going to be funded by the bond. So we'll still have that as well. So we're really looking at having a conversation, and we're taking a two-week break with our architects. We're coming back on the 3rd of September, and they're really taking a look at programmatically what does each one of those modules within the buildings that we had, what did they cost, and really where can we reduce the size and get what we need and still potentially offer some of the additional amenities that the community has asked for.
Also before the election, members of the public will be able to write arguments for and against bonding. Interim Clerk Melina Stevens says her office will disseminate that alongside other election information.
That will then result in a separate website, essentially, or page of our website that will be posted that has that information, so the public has access to that, as well as a mailer that will go out so the public has awareness of the pro and con statements.
Only voters in the 84098 zip code will decide whether to issue the bonds, since only taxpayers in that zip code will be paying it off. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Last night, Park City had its regular city council meeting. Here to tell us about what went on, we have Ryan Dickey. Morning, Mayor Ryan Dickey.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Thank you for being here. Okay, Ryan, there were a number of, it was actually not that deep a meeting in terms of the number of things you talked about, but some of them were pretty interesting. The first one I wanted to ask you about was, you heard a presentation about this airport connector project. Tell me what that's about.
Yeah, what comes out of this Emerging Disruptors Transportation Committee we had a couple years ago, and the one idea that came out that the council got excited about was this idea of a connector from the airport into local hotels that combines individual trips. Today, you know, you're getting a black car or an Uber, you're renting a car, so combined trips into a local shuttle. This is something that exists in Colorado, where the resorts are a little farther apart, shared shuttles, you know, Super Shuttle, Colorado Mountain Express. We just don't have that. We talked about that last night. I guess that's really driven by, you know, an Uber to Vail from, you know, DIA is $400. Here you can actually, you know, get to town affordably. So the idea is a hourly shuttle from the airport that actually goes around to local hotels and drops you off.
So, well, but isn't there similar shuttle services, or traditionally have been similar shuttle van services that are, you know, sort of run privately? How is this, if it's just going to go to multiple sites, how is this any different than that?
Yeah, I think they have, but we really don't actually have that from Salt Lake today. Uber and Lyft and, you know, shared rides.
Oh, they pushed those guys out?
They pushed them out. I mean, we heard last night, you know, that 20 years ago, a taxi from the airport cost $100. And without, you know, inflation, we're at 60 or 70 in an Uber. Like, it disrupted that market.
And one of the things I was reading, and it sounded to me as though they were thinking about a situation where you would be taken to a central hotel, a central stop, and then various hotel shuttles would come and meet you there, as opposed to going from hotel to hotel.
That came up as a question, but yeah. The concept with the chamber and the local provider is direct to hotel. And they had that concern, you know, do people want to change their luggage three times on the way to a ski trip? There's a point where they're just going to hop in an Uber.
Exactly. Okay, so where does it stand?
Council said, we want to know more. There's a financial ask, and there was no number, and so it was just more of a directional, hey, should we go work on this? And the answer from the council was yes.
And the real reason that the city, I'm thinking about, why do we have government involvement in this kind of transportation issue when it sounds as though there are a number of private sector responses? What is the reason that the chamber, whoever it is that's pushing this, thinks it should have city involvement?
Well, I think they're saying that this is, it's a traffic solution from the city's perspective. It's combining trips.
Okay.
It wouldn't be run out of our transit department. It's not something we'd run as transit. But it's sort of like seed money saying, hey, help us get this off the ground. The opportunity isn't good enough for the private sector to actually go after it themselves. I mean, there was skepticism, though, to be clear, on the council about that. I asked questions about that. You know, Councilmember Sirocco, like, hey, this seems like something the private sector does really well. The original concept was more of a you know, Disney Cruise Lines where you leave your bags and you don't see them again until they show up in your hotel room.
That would be nice.
That's differentiating.
That would be nice.
Great.
Yeah.
And like the direction, you know, I said, let's make sure this is an investment in the economy that has an economic return and not just, you know, a competitor to the private market or actually stifling the private sector from coming to us, you know, privately.
So basically where it gets left is, the council basically asked for more information before. There hasn't even been a formal economic ask yet.
No formal ask. It's a 2-year pilot, yes. 15 weeks at a time, I think. And so we said, hey, we're interested. Bring us back details, and then we'll decide.
You'll actually be able to look at results to make a decision, I take it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pilot. It's not like we're standing up a permanent service. So it's, but you know, there's money involved, so we got to be conscientious.
There was a staff report on the Main Street area plan.
Yes.
Tell us about, well, first of all, give us a little background. How did this come up?
So if you recall, a couple of years ago, we had a pretty ambitious Main Street area plan encompassing Sweet Alley, Main Street, you know, a lot of improvements to our downtown core that cut, you know, addresses a problem statement, which is we have declining visitation to Main Street absent a COVID boost from 2017. So visitation declines every year. Spending has declined every year since 2023.
And sales tax revenues, therefore.
And sales tax revenue. We have fewer people walking on Main Street today than 2017. And that's shocking. And that is counter to local perception, but the competition around us is completely different than it was 20 years ago. When you look at investments in our region, in Salt Lake, you know, our number one visitor is a drive visitor, you know, throughout the year. And, you know, now we're gonna have $1 billion in the Power District. We've got, you know, East Village didn't exist. We're gonna have immense competition for workforce and the consumer. Main Street is awesome today. It's our jewel. It's what no one can replicate, but it's not very pedestrian friendly. The sidewalks are narrow. You know, we hear from visitors that it's really neat, but not really. You know, we have people walking in the street all winter, dodging cars. Like, how do we make this something that, you know, as we've always done, how do we continue to just refresh Main Street to make it a great experience?
And what are some of the things being considered? Were there formal proposals kicked around last night?
It was really a question to the council. Out of that Main Street area plan, which the council did not adopt, it basically grabbed a couple pieces in isolation, a traffic and circulation study, an aerial transit study, that really don't make sense to do without a plan. Like, you know, our staff came to us and said, hey, we're doing a circulation study, but what are we circulating to? Are you doing something on Sweet Alley? The China Bridge Garage, you know, we've heard needs to be replaced in the next 4 to 5 years. Are we taking down a large structured surface parking garage and really rebuilding that? Or are we putting the parking underground and having some complementary development improvements on Sweet Alley, which today is our primary point of entry to Old Town and Main Street and is, you know, it's a parking garage and a bunch of dumpsters, and it's not pedestrian friendly. So that circulation study has come up with some exciting ideas. We didn't dig into those. But the question before council was, do you guys want to come back and create a plan? It can be less ambitious, more ambitious, different concepts. But do we need a cohesive plan, or are we piecemealing these ideas? And what we heard from council is, yeah, we need a plan. We really want to focus on Sweet Alley. We have you know, we want to look closely at China Bridge, make sure this is really that need that we think it is, and this catalyst for action. We want to think about phasing, you know. So the direction was, yeah, we need a plan.
And there was some conversation when you talk about sort of the circulation study and the circulating changes about changing the width of the sidewalks, changing the width of the street. Just to flesh out just a little bit at a conceptual level about some of the things people are thinking about.
Yeah, so the sort of initial concept is, you know, on Main Street, something that is sort of a single surface street, wide sidewalks, something that can easily be closed for pedestrians, but I think we see, you know, a future where we have that street closed a lot, you know, both with external factors. You know, we had to close it in Sundance. Crowded pedestrian streets tend to get closed for security and for the pedestrian experience. So that's wider sidewalks and a place where people can really walk around Main Street and be feel free and visit local businesses and stay for longer. On Sweet Alley, you could make really a complementary street. You know, we talked about our code today says Sweet Alley shall be subordinate to Main Street. Roger's eyeballing the beauty of Sweet Alley right here from the studio. Yes, we could have wide sidewalks on Sweet Alley and make it a pleasant place to be, maybe more commercial real estate. You know, we have just really zero vacancy always on Main Street. We have some missing business segments. You could really make it complimentary to the experience and a really nice way to come into Old Town.
And I guess one thing you could do is if you got rid of a lane of one of the parking on one side of the street in Main Street, you could, it would facilitate the ability to widen it, I assume, widen the pedestrian access.
I mean, that's where, if you want to widen the sidewalks, you're talking about losing
parking. Yeah, you're going to have to do something.
And so that's where the opportunity comes from. Hey, if you have to rebuild China Bridge anyway, you can dig down as deeply as you like and create the same amount of parking one block over, but on a street where you actually are happy to be walking instead of, you know, how it feels today.
And obviously, there is a big philosophical question you guys are going to have to wrestle with about what the role of parking with respect to Main Street is. Is there any sort of notion that you would actually reduce the parking availability here on Main Street?
There's never been an idea that we would reduce parking in the district, but we've always toted the idea that you could take parking off of Main Street and shift it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So it's really a question of just where the parking is. There's no conversation about reducing parking.
You mentioned aerial transit. Every time I hear people areas, you mentioned that people's eyebrows go up. What were the two, there, and as I read the staff report, and maybe I didn't read it correctly, there were preliminary cost estimates for an aerial transit from both from this area, the China Bridge area to Snow Park, and from the Richardson Flat area to Snow Park. Did you guys discuss those?
That study's been in progress, so we did discuss that a little bit. Those are the two routes. You have, you know, on Deer Valley side, that's Deer Valley's building a big brand new base area. That's also a threat to Main Street. We want to make it really easy for folks in Deer Valley to come spend money on Main Street and make sure we're making those trips. Richardson Flat to Snow Park, really more of a transportation feature that takes cars off our entry corridor. So those are preliminary. They're really hard. I mean, you got a lot of private land, you know, especially between Richardson Flat and Snow Park. And certainly as you think about going from China Bridge up and over Marsac Avenue to Deer Valley, those are difficult routes, and that's why you see those price tags. But I mean, at the end of the day, they're completely feasible. All it takes is money, some aerial rights, so you can do it.
Well, you mentioned that the price tags for both of them were in the $40 million range?
Yeah, so it ranges from $30 to $50 million.
And do those numbers include the eminent domain, you know, the sort of private property rights? Because I looked at those and I thought, those can't be full in.
I don't know if that actually includes estimates for eminent domain. The route to Snow Park, there's a lot of city and Deer Valley land in between, so it's pretty feasible. It depends. Really what drives the cost is not the length of the trip, but the angle stations, how many turns you make. And so that's why just the route from China Bridge to Snow Park, there's a $33 million route and a $53 million route. It just depends on how you do it. I mean, these are big ideas. You know, we really focused on Main Street and actually said aerial transit should be on this separate track. You know, let's keep pursuing it, but big and hard.
Okay, so that helps. So when we talk about a unified plan, you really are focusing on Main Street, China Bridge, for the need to get a unified plan, and almost aerial is on a parallel or maybe higher track.
For now, I think that's where we are. And you can, you know, if we have a gondola station in the future that's, you know, part of the rebuild on Sweet Alley, then you'd wrap it in.
I couldn't help but notice there was some discussion of snowmelt. And I looked at that and I went, are they really talking about, like, you know, melting the snow on Main Street and the sidewalks?
Well, you sound skeptical, but the idea is absolutely. Geothermal heat loops are a tested, proven technology. Vail Village is using them to heat their village, replace their snowmelt system. Absolutely proven. It's nothing you would do if you weren't already tearing up the street.
And that's the key point, is you're talking about geothermal. I know there was a geothermal, was it an experimental dig over in Bonanza? Two weeks ago, I saw what looked like a well. I said, they aren't looking for water.
You drill boreholes and then you assess the suitability for, is it creating the right temperatures?
Right,
you basically use the ground and wastewater to heat and cool.
And are the results from that test bore, do you know?
I haven't seen the results. Okay. I think the main result is people thought that we were starting construction on the 5 acres from the drills, and we were not. So we'll get the results later.
And that is, of course, a natural segue to the 5 acres, something that lots of people are talking about. Lots of public comment about the 5 acres, apparently more than 1,500 signatures. I want to ask you, you know, how, in your mind, is that affecting the decision-making process going forward?
Yeah, I mean, we're always listening to our residents, and we're always looking at public sentiment. people come for public comment. You know, I ran on Chambers being a welcoming place, and we did an hour and 15 minutes or so of public comment the other day, and I try to welcome every person who comes to the podium because they are welcome. We want to feel welcome. We want to hear what they have to say. This project is on two tracks, just like it has been. There's a planning commission track to assess the land use. There's a council track where we work on the development agreement, which is the financial piece and actually, you know, sort of locks in the uses and the final form of the development. So right now the project's at planning commission. So we hear those residents who, you know, want to have a park or other uses or don't like the project. We get a lot of feedback from folks who do support the project. You know, there's not a big constituency for mixed use development that's organized to come show up and support the project. We do hear from them. As with any, you know, construction, big projects, you know, the organized opposition is going to show up. So fully expected that. But absolutely, we listen. These are our residents. These are our neighbors. And no one expected that this project would be sent to Planning Commission, come back exactly the same. We put a bow on it and put a shovel in the ground. The project's going to evolve. We're always listening.
Political thinkers, and this is my philosophical question from you. Political thinkers from Edmund Burke to Churchill to Kennedy have all talked about how elected policymakers have to balance their own judgment versus what popular sentiment says. And what is your obligation? Talk to me about your philosophy with respect to how you make those kinds of balancing decisions.
Right. I mean, this is sort of your first year as a poli-sci major, right?
Yep.
This is a key question, and there's actually no answer. You find yourself somewhere in the middle. We don't have direct democracy for a reason. Doesn't work very well. We have a representative democracy. You balance it sort of piece by piece. I mean, I think you have to look at, we never want to, you know, run counter to some overwhelming public sentiment. We also in local government don't really have a good gauge on public sentiment. We don't have polling. We hear from, the people who don't like something show up, the people who do like something tend not to. So we do our best. We do open houses. You know, we're talking about widening, creating a multi-use path on Little Kate Road. We've had multiple open houses, right? Like to widen a sidewalk, I mean, fundamentally. So we really do try to listen. I think specifically when it comes to building something, to building housing, adding any kind of density, you know, we are not unique in this country. We tend to divorce ourselves from the big picture in the country at large. But this is a problem that is everywhere, that, you know, in this country, local government struggles to build anything. And we have a massive housing shortage in this country because of that, because the regulatory tools are there. The public shows up to stop development. And so we want to be responsive to our residents, and we are. At the same time, there's hard stuff that we want to get done that once it's done, you look back, you say, well, I'm glad we really did that. Engine House, right? Like, yeah. Lots of public opposition, 120 units of housing. Now it's a successful project. No one would give back. Look at Sammy's, the strip mall where Sammy's is. Imagine if we were proposing a strip mall. There'd be a lot of unhappiness with that, but would we give the strip mall that has Sammy's and the sandwich shop back? No. People love to go to places where there's coffee and restaurants and parking. We always look back, the ski bridge, the roundabout, all of these projects that we've done in town that are hard changes, and you look back and go, well, that was great. So there's this balance between doing things that are hard and trying to lead and bring the public along. And then when you get to a point where you're trying to lead and the public doesn't come along, then of course you figure out how to evolve what you're doing. We're not trying to force something through against the public will, but we're trying to make sure we also paint the picture of what this development really is. And then if there's some kind of a change, what the options really are.
Ryan Dickey, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me in, Roger. Appreciate it.
Helen Nadel is the executive director of Summit Community Gardens and Eats. She joins me in the studio bearing some kind of interesting vegetable to talk about what's cooking out in the gardens. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning, Roger. How are you?
Oh, wait. There you go. Once again, I'm doing well. So let's start with background. Quickly, can you remind listeners about how Summit Community Gardens and Eats was formed and what the mission is.
Sure, yeah. Summit Community Gardens and Eats provides food education that connects about 2,000 kiddos, 3 through 14 years old, to how food grows, to cooking, and to healthy eating. We grow and distribute fruits and vegetables to address food insecurity through a couple of different initiatives, Fruit to Schools and the Food Pharmacy, which is a collaboration with the People's Health Clinic. And then we also steward the county's only public community garden that engages about 2,000 people each summer. So really, we are all about building community through food.
And it really was the merger of two prior not-for-profits, right?
Yeah, and that was, I mean, gosh, that was about three and a half, four years ago now, yeah.
So when are you going to streamline the name?
You know, more news on that actually in October with Leslie. So you'll have to listen in when I come back.
All right,
so
that was a tease.
Yeah.
What's going on in the garden right now?
Oh my gosh. Well, it is high summer in the community garden. If you drive by, we welcome you to come in. It is open to anybody all the time. Gates are always open. You will see hundreds of sunflowers just sprinkled all over the garden. There are so many fabulous kinds of vegetables. We've got pollinators, hummingbirds, just buzzing around. It's really a beautiful spot, nestled right under the mountains, 360 views. We just finished garden camp, which was really a spectacular success. We had 250 kiddos in the garden throughout the summer over 9 weeks. And I think, Roger, it's the only camp in Park City where you hear children ask, can I please go and pick more Swiss chard? We had our last dinner in the garden last night. This was a beautiful program where we really introduced a lot of people to the garden. A lot of supporters come for these beautiful dinners, under the mountains. I want to just thank our partners. Last night we had Shabu, it was sold out. Every dinner we had was sold out. Really? So Shabu was last night. Thanks to them, and also to Hill's Kitchen, to Tupelo, to Red Banjo Pizza, to Esti Pizzeria, Auntie M's, and then of course Twisted Fern and Loma. And the Summit County Restaurant Tax, of course. This week in the garden, our garden team, Jess and Luce, harvested a lot of beautiful food that our team grows for the food pharmacy. So squash, onions, lettuce, kale, chilies and peppers, and basil went out to 35 people who are food insecure and experiencing chronic diseases in our community. So that's a important part of what we do at Summit Community Gardens and Eats. And then, of course, there's we have 130 garden plots that individual community members will garden in every year. And there is just a ton of food growing in those individual plots and also in the U-Pick area. There's a new area called the Snacking Garden. People can just visit, again, come into the garden anytime. It's county land. We really welcome you. There is an area to the left with lots of signs that you can see where you can just come pick. Right now there's dill, there's basil, there's rosemary, there's cilantro. We've got kale, collards, and chard. The kids did leave some chard for everybody to pick. We have some cucumbers. There's going to be, coming up the next few weeks, carrots and tomatoes. So please come and visit us. And while we're at it, I wanted to, the last few times I've been on, I've spent some time talking about cooking with local produce.
Yes.
I think last time I talked tomatoes and I talked summer squash, I talked zucchini. Please, those are still abundant everywhere. But I wanted to talk a little bit about two other vegetables. One is corn, my favorite things to do with corn right now. We do have corn growing in the community garden, some fabulous short season varieties of corn, small ears, but they're ready to go. So we're happy about that. My favorite, there's a lot that I love to do with corn. Obviously eating it off the cob, cannot go wrong. Nature's bounty, it's beautiful. But the other thing that, the other things I love to do with corn, saute up any kind of onion, leek, scallion, any kind of spring onion that you've got, and then cut off the ears of the corn into that pan, saute it with a little bit of butter or olive oil, a little bit of salt and pepper, and then really any herb, any green thing you've got, it could be spinach, could be asparagus, could be green beans, sugar snap peas, right now are amazing. So that is a total delight. You can just have that as a side dish. You can make that into a pasta, just boil up some pasta, maybe add a little Parmesan cheese. You've got a great vegetarian dinner. So that's really one of my favorite things to do. Also just cutting up fresh corn into any salad. I mean, it just brightens it and it is beautiful. And then Roger, I want to bring in these lovely vegetables.
Yes.
The team out front when I came in was all a flutter about what these could be. Any guesses? I know it's a little hard to see.
Oh, that looks like a squash to me on the right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So these are patty pan squashes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't realize that, you know, these are sort of flat. They can come in light yellow, dark green. I've got a variety here that's like double grown. So you've got two squash attached, kind of conjoined, like twins, that are yellow with a green top. These squash are fantastic. They are great, just roasted in the oven, 400 degrees, olive oil, salt, always my favorite way to do any vegetable.
Right.
Super simple, just, you know, you roast it until it's a little brown on one side, flip it over so you get that nice caramelization. That works really well with patty pan squash as well as any other summer squash.
Before we run out of time, I want to make sure I get to ask you about Farm to Fork.
Oh my goodness. Well, that is our big fundraiser. There are tickets still available, but going fast. And every ticket helps us create really meaningful opportunities for local kids to grow, to cook, to explore outdoors, and to really connect with their food and community. We have 2,000 kids in food literacy education in schools. We have food access programs for young people. Roger, if you can imagine a serving of a fruit or a vegetable, an apple, you know, a pile of green beans, we provide 14,000 servings of fruits and vegetables to kids every year.
And in a community this size, that's a remarkable amount.
It is. Yeah. It is. And I think, you know, there is a lot of food insecurity in our community. So important to remember that. Our Farm to Fork fundraiser is super fun. We try to keep it's elevated, but it's pretty informal. It's up at Pendry Park City. Special shout out to Pendry Park City for providing this gorgeous space for us. We do a short program, of course. Raising funds is a part of it. We always have just a few food and garden experiences. So this year, just a couple of them I'm going to highlight. One is pediatrician chef Dr. Bonnie Fiola, who is helping to make family mealtimes calmer. She has a wonderful business to connect and consult with parents. She's providing some coaching sessions and a whole lot more. And then one other thing I want to highlight is that Alpine Distilling, just right up the street, is going to provide a private cocktail party experience for you and 12 to 20 of your best friends. So we've got some really fun other things as well. People can come and enjoy a beautiful evening, or if they can't come, we've got a great opportunity drawing with some gorgeous treats and prizes there. More information and tickets are on our website. That is summitcommunitygardens.org.
We've been speaking with Helen Nadel of Park City Community Garden /Eats. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Back Alley Bash kicks off tonight here at City Park. Here to talk about it, we have Sarah Irvin and Amber Johnson. Morning, guys.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. Yes, tonight is the night, Roger.
Well, it's actually even earlier. It's day in tonight.
Yeah, we shifted it up a little bit. We have a new time tonight from 4 to 8 p.m. And this is, as Roger said, the KPCW Cole Sport Back Alley Bash. They've been the title sponsor with us for, we've kind of lost track of time. Like we say 40-ish years, would you guys say? That's pretty appropriate. But it's going to be a super, super fun night. It's just
I claim to be 40-ish years for a number of years. no longer get away with it.
Well, it's working for us so far. And so what we'll have is from 4 to 6, we'll have the band Lash LaRue that will take the stage. And then from 6 to 8, we'll have the Silver King Rocking Company that'll just going to be taking over. We'll also be there tonight. We'll have a booth on the side. We'll be selling some swag. Sarah, I see you're sporting your Back Alley Bash t-shirt. So we're going to be selling these really, really cool t-shirts. And also have some free swag. We'll have bubbles and frisbees for the kids. And if you've never been to the Back Alley Bash, it truly is like the social event of the season, I feel like, in Park City. It just is such a fun night where community comes together to just celebrate just this amazing place that we live.
It kind of ranks up there with Halloween, the first night of Arts Fest, in terms of you see everybody you haven't seen for a while.
It's true. And with it being, back to school time, this is a great way to celebrate the end of summer. We hope families come out. This is a free event. It's very family friendly. We'll have kids activities, face painter, balloon twist, register, games, bring your picnic blankets, bring your lawn chairs. It's a BYO event. Pack your coolers, pack your picnic baskets. We will have some food for sale. The corn dog truck will be back this year. That one was a big hit last year. as well as there will be dirty sodas for sale.
It's a mix
of all soda flavors, Roger. And those will be for sale as well. Yeah, thanks to Tiki 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 for those. But really, it's just a great way to celebrate, you know, what makes living here in the mountains so special, live music and warm nights.
And that first band, that is the successor to Motherlode Canyon, isn't it?
Lash LaRue.
Yes.
Okay, and then Silver King Rock & Co. is the rebranded Mud Puddle.
Mud Puddle.
Dana Williams and Dude and the whole gang. So, and many thanks to Mountain Town Music as well for helping produce the sound and getting the live music up there. We will also be broadcasting live from City Park, so be sure to drop by and say hi to Claire Wiley. She'll be doing the local view from the City Park lawn from 3 to 6 p.m. But again, the music starts at 4, and it's really the kickoff to our summer fundraising cycle, which is, of course, the Summer Pledge Drive. That will take over the airwaves the week of September 14th, but we are starting to count donations now towards our fundraising goals. And we really hope that when the community comes out and hangs with us this evening, they feel inspired as well to support this station, because we are completely community-centric and community-supported. So we really do rely on our listener support for all of what you hear here on KPCW, from local news to original programming and everything in between.
And we still, you know, we did lose some federal funding a couple of years ago, and it's really important that the service we provide to the community, we need support to keep doing it.
Exactly. We're in our second year without federal funding, and you'll hear us talk about it, but it really is, it's a huge hit to us. $250,000 last year, $250,000 this year. You know, that's a huge hit to a small station like ours, and so we are looking to increase local support so that we can keep bringing you these local services.
Sarah Irvin, Amber Johnson, we'll see you tonight at the Back Alley Bash.
Thanks, Roger.
Thanks for coming in.